The vulnerability of the human body is frightening and bloody. But when Ariane Zwartjes was training to be an emergency medical technician, she heard poetry in that vulnerability. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Now Zwartjes is sharing the poetry she heard with the rest of us. Her new book is Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy. In the book, she explores the many types of wounds from which a human body can suffer and heal, physical and emotional. This hour, I'll talk with her about her life, her work teaching wilderness medicine, writing poetry, and we'll talk about our ability to live and love in spite of suffering and loss. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Ariane Zwartjes was training to be an emergency medical technician, she fell in love with the language of anatomy. But in learning about all the different parts of the body, she was also learning about the different ways it could be injured. Her new book is Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy, and it explores the many ways that the human body can be injured in a lyrical way. It's published by the University of Iowa Press, and in addition to her writing, she's also the director of the Wilderness Program at the United World College in New Mexico. Ariane, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Charity. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want you to take us back to 2008 when you were training to be an EMT, an emergency medical technician. What were you learning that made you think of poetry?
Well, the textbook for the EMT course goes into quite a bit of depth about anatomy and anatomical terms. And I just kept stumbling across this language, which was so amazing. Things like the cardiac skeleton and the Purkinje trees and the carina and the islets of Langerhans. They just all seemed so poetic to me.
And as I mentioned, at the same time, of course, you were learning about what would happen to a human being if these different areas of the body that you were learning about were injured. It seems to me that that would have sucked a lot of the poetry out of the experience.
You know, I grew up with a father who was an ER doctor, and we would go over to the ER at night to bring him some extra food or something. And so I think I've grown up within a very sort of pragmatic context about the human body and about injury in that sense. And maybe it's just a personal gift as well that it doesn't sort of flap me as much as it does some people. And we all have our things, right? But I think blood and guts is not my thing in terms of getting thrown off balance. And so I really wasn't distracted in that sense. I think I really enjoy the adrenaline of being a medic and taking care of people who are injured or ill. And at the same time, I totally geek out on the scientific background and the anatomy and the language of it.
Well, maybe you can give us an example of how you've brought this together from your book. And in the book, not only do you bring together descriptions of the human body and frailty of the human body, but also our emotions as well, the three things to seem to be linked to you.
Yes, I imagine we might talk about this a bit more later in the show, but I've always found it really useful to take a language set, and I seem to be particularly attracted to language sets that come from science and math, and to contrast that with more personal explorations. I think it, in a way, helps balance the personal introspection and keep it from becoming too sort of sentimental or self-indulgent. And it also introduces this extra fascinating, geeky level to the project, which I really enjoy.
Well, would you read for us a little bit from your book and from this section entitled Liver?
Absolutely. It always amazes me to hear radio commentators talking about the need for our economy to start growing again, as though it can be always increasing, as though increasing can be a permanent state of being, and as though we somehow, as a nation, are entitled to that upness. And yet in our own personal lives, we are all too aware that up is a transient state, that our hearts are precariously poised, and that somewhere above are crushing weights, glacial erratics, boulders tipped up on end and balanced. And so as we go about our business of falling in love, drinking beer together, walking in the desert together, waking up with dogs and blankets piled heavily on our legs, an edge of my brain is always already worrying at it, assessing the trade-off, calculating risk and regrowth, heart steeling against its possible future absence. But perhaps, after all, the heart is not the best example on which to base our paradigm for loving. Had we grown up in Morocco amongst the Berber people, our declarations of love, of poetic exaltation or emotional disarray, would come from the liver. Similarly, during Elizabethan times in Britain, it was thought that the liver produced our blood, and that romance was aroused by an increase in the volume of the body's blood. Thus, liver, and not heart, was the organ associated with love. In some ways, this metaphor seems more apt, though somewhat less lyrical, for the liver possesses its own kind of miracle. The liver, when damaged, is capable of regeneration, able to regrow into a whole functioning organ from as little as one quarter of its former self. This seems a crucial talent for a body part associated with the bracing risk, the frequent shatter and rupture of love. To be torn apart and finally rebuild so fully. After all, in the end, despite all our worry, mostly we go about our business of falling in love. We are not stopped. Even with some fear, the momentum is too great. But this idea of falling, this too began in Elizabethan times, as though we were falling ill. Psychologist Frank Tallis describes love as a mine, ready to explode as soon as the tripwires of desire and longing begin to tremble. Of our phrasing, he writes, the innocent cadence of falling in love conceals a number of alarming truths about love that the unconscious mind readily acknowledges and which the conscious mind ignores at its peril. We fall in love, according to him, like we fall over, seemingly by accident, not by design. And when we fall in love, we are again occupying the landscape of ancient Greece, where theomania can strike us down at the whim of a minor god. And yet we continue to take this risk over and over and over. So to be able to regenerate after each explosion, to rebuild cells and tissues, to fill the hollowed-out rooms and blackened doorways of the self, perhaps this is the capacity we need most, of whichever organ we identify as the mainstay, the nucleus of our emotions of love.
Ariane Zwartjes reading from her new book, Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy. As you began to write about the body and about the things that you learned about as an EMT and the different trauma that you had seen through helping people, things that had happened to you and to others in your life, did you find that the idea of emotional trauma kept sneaking its way in?
I did. You know, initially, and this may seem a little ironic, initially I started this project as a love story for this character, Dave, who appears periodically throughout the project. And I think I was exploring what it means to be in love and at the same time be continuously confronted with our own mortality, with the possibility of death and damage and you know, the world changing. And as I wrote the project, or by the time I finished the project, that relationship had dissolved. But I realized by that point that it was actually a project about living with uncertainty and about finding a certain kind of grace with your body, these mortal bodies we live in, and really about learning to love your very, very fallible, imperfect self and to accept vulnerability.
As you write about the liver and love, and you go on, you do write about this person, Dave, and you write about understanding his physical vulnerability as well, as you teach him to ride a motorcycle, and then he's riding your motorcycle, which is not in the best of condition at, you know, at full throttle. And did you find that when you learned more about how vulnerable our bodies were, that you were constantly assessing risk?
Yes, I really did. And, you know, I became an EMT just at the same time as Dave and I were sort of falling in love. And so I'm not sure which heightened my level of awareness more, but I really found that during this process of falling in love, it almost felt like I had more to lose or something. I became more reluctant in certain arenas. I became a little more risk aware as a rock climber, clearly in this moment of teaching Dave to ride this motorcycle. I was somewhat horrified by his approach to riding it because he hadn't quite mastered the subtleties of the clutch, so he just rode it full bore. But that was really, you know, in contrast with my awareness of him as this person who also had these deathly allergies to all kinds of medical drugs and yet was constantly out there playing rough and getting injured, and that sort of knowledge that he wouldn't be able to take antibiotics if he developed an infection was really sort of the epitome of this dual awareness for me of trying to live fully in the moment and not fear, and yet having this knowledge of how vulnerable and mortal we really are.
There's a phenomenon that happens to a lot of medical students as they go through their medical training and they're learning about all of these different diseases. There is a lot of hypochondria that comes into play because, of course, you know, as they read about all these diseases, they start diagnosing themselves. And in your case, you were focusing specifically on trauma. So did you find yourself playing out all of these different scenarios in which you could get injured?
You know, I'm not sure that it quite operates like that for me. I think it's just sort of a heightened awareness of everyone's capacity to break. Although my father, who, as I mentioned, is an ER doctor, has sort of been accusing me recently of that medical school student phenomenon of knowing just enough that it's dangerous. But I've found that I've sort of strangely become the person that my friends all call when they, you know, get a thorn through their foot or potentially have a head injury and aren't sure what to do. So I'm sort of in this funny realm where, you know, I'm only an EMT. We don't have sort of an immense body of knowledge, but I have sort of taken up this role of the medic in my community of friends, which has been sort of amusing and but also sort of an honor in a certain way.
I'm talking with Ariane Zwarcza. She is the author of the new book Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy, out from University of Iowa Press. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us. We'd love to hear your stories about when you realized your own personal vulnerability or your own personal resilience. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Ariane Zwarcza. She is the author most recently of Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy. And she also is the director of the Wilderness Program at the United World College in New Mexico. And Ariane, what led you to become an EMT?
Well, as I mentioned, I grew up around medical things to some degree, although I never harbored the aspiration to, you know, become a doctor or go into medicine in that way. I think I always knew I was going to be a writer when I grew up, quote unquote. But I, in about 2005, started leading 30-day backpacking trips for a program called the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS. And to lead those trips, you have to have a 10-day wilderness medicine training called a wilderness first responder. So I'd actually had that training for a number of years. I first got it in 1997 when I was working with a search and rescue team in New Mexico. And I'd always really loved that training and that knowledge. And after I started working for NOLS, I thought that maybe I would like to teach for their wilderness medicine program. And so that was a fairly large part of my initial impulse to take the EMT training. But I also was living in Seattle at the time, and I was very interested in working on an ambulance for, you know, a year or two in Seattle. It wasn't what I thought I would do long term, but I was interested in the short term experience. I think I always have envisioned this sort of alter ego version of myself who's gone to medical school and is working with Doctors Without Borders and all of that. I don't think I'll ever do that, but I really enjoy thinking about this sort of alternate self who might be doing that in another parallel reality.
What did you learn during that time working on an ambulance?
You know, I didn't end up doing that. I ended up going back down to Arizona and working for Knowles, and that was when I met Dave and sort of got pulled in a different direction. So what I ended up doing down in Tucson was doing a bunch of volunteer work in one of the emergency rooms down there and then starting to teach for the Wilderness Medicine Institute.
And what is the Wilderness Medicine Institute?
It's a program that now is a part of Knowles. It started as a separate organization, but we teach wilderness medicine courses all over the country, everything from two-day basic wilderness first aid courses up to the 30-day wilderness EMT courses, which is kind of a combination of urban EMT training with the wilderness medicine knowledge. And it's just such a delight to teach for them. It's a lot of hands-on experience, and the students in general really want to be there and are really excited to learn the skills because they need it usually for their jobs, for guiding or for working for the Forest Service or being, you know, backcountry firefighters. So,
what drew you to that kind of work?
I've always loved teaching, and I've taught in a pretty wide variety of different environments. I've taught performance poetry in New York City to students from all over the city after school. I've taught in a family shelter in the South Bronx. I've taught English in a variety of places, including the University of Arizona. And then I've been, you know, leading these courses for Knowles, which is a lot of teaching of leadership and technical backcountry skills. So I think, you know, it was a perfect combination of my interest in medical skills and also my immense love of teaching.
In the book, you give us glimpses into some of the things that you enjoy doing. We talked about the motorcycle riding, and there's the rock climbing as well. Clearly, you're somebody who lives a fairly adventurous life. Did you find that as you learned more about vulnerability, that you did stop doing some of those things or second guess yourself?
That's a really good question. It's, you know, it's hard to tell what's a function of getting a little bit older and what's a function of the medical knowledge. I don't actually own a motorcycle right now, although I haven't ruled out the possibility of owning one again. When I was with Dave, actually, he was buying bikes and fixing them up, so I would just ride the bikes that he was fixing. And I also haven't been climbing a lot lately, but I think that that's for different sort of factors and reasons in my life. I do feel aware of risk, but in some ways I think I've always sort of had that aspect to my personality. So I'm not sure that I've
as a risk taker or the awareness of risk.
Yeah, I think I've had an awareness of risk. I've always been adventurous, but it definitely always had a little edge of risk awareness to it.
And do you think that made you be more careful?
I mean, I do. I think that, you know, I've sort of done all these activities and had all these adventures that I think some people would perceive as really far out there. But I actually think that within those adventures, I was always a bit conservative. I was always very safety minded when I was riding a motorcycle. And, you know, when I first bought a motorcycle, I was 19 and I made a promise to myself that I would never ride it without a helmet. And so, you know, I think within the realm of adventure, I've always sort of had some awareness of self-preservation, which my parents might dispute, but they might also be glad to hear me say that.
I'm talking with Arianne Zwartje. She's the author of Detailing Trauma, Poetic Anatomy. And we'd love to hear from you this hour as well. If you had an experience that revealed to you your vulnerability, We'd love to hear about that. Or maybe an experience that revealed to you your resilience, your physical resilience, or even your emotional resilience. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Ariana, I'd love for you to read a little bit more from your book for us. Could you read from De Breedman?
Absolutely. De Breedman. And after we are wounded, after our world is shattered by loss, reassurance is hard to come by. The precipice is still a precipice from the other side, from the bottom. We find ourselves a shaky, knitted together place to stand, are perhaps a little purified, like rising from flames, by the absoluteness of it, by having lost what was unbearable, unsurvivable to lose, and finding ourselves still breathing. But that's all we are at this moment, still breathing, but broken, and at the bottom of this very tall precipice, with no clue as to how to ascend, back to the flat plains of the living. Back with at least one foot into the land of pretending again. We are safe. Those we love are safe. There is no precipice. Though some nights I wake fearful, wishing this city had less heroin and fewer gunshots, the truth is that fracture is everywhere. Our hearts are our whole bodies, and our wounds are visible. We are atoms in a fragmented universe. Seen this way, individuals begin to blur. Journalists use the term compassion fatigue. What Ernest Becker called the denial of death is a kind of reality fatigue. And yet. Doctors may choose to surgically remove dead or damaged tissue to promote the healing of a laceration. This is known as debriding the wound, and is most often done to create clean wound edges and decrease scarring, or to remove infected and necrotic tissue. What is it that happens as fracture occurs, if it doesn't entirely break us, though sometimes it does? But sometimes the shattered vessel fills with light. Sometimes the fracture opens us. Sometimes we become not less, but more alive, like the discomfort of standing on a high ridge, soaked in slicing gray rain, scoured by wind. Bracing. Perhaps this scouring can shed what isn't needed, sloughing off the dead skin built up over years of living, in fear of breaking, our faces turned away. Throughout my whole life, wrote Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, during every minute of it, the world has been gradually lighting up and blazing before my eyes until it has come to surround me, entirely lit up from within. This is a man who has known fracture. We live steeped in its burning layers.
Ariane Zwartjes reading from Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy. And one of the reasons I suggested that you read that section, Ariane, is that De Breedman is really the least poetic thing that I can think of in many ways. I mean, cutting away dead tissue. How did you find poetry in that?
Well, you know, I think there's something in my roots as a poet. I really like working with the idea of fragmentation, and I really like the idea of language being beautiful, but also being sharp and breaking, to being always breaking. And I think that somehow creates space for it to be new, if only for that sharp second. And so, I mean, in a way, that's, you know, De Breedman is connected to that. It's this sort of cutting away of what's dead and calloused and getting down to what's raw, which I'm sure in some ways sounds awful, but I think as a poet, I'm drawn to that for some reason. I like that feeling of rawness and of experiencing the world without callous.
In an interview that you gave, I read that you said your first book of poetry really kind of emerged from you in a very short period of time, and that this project took you 4 years. Why do you think this was so much harder for you?
Yeah, it's funny. They were really polar opposites. I think part of it is that when I sat down to write that book of poetry, I didn't have preconceived notions about what it would be. I just showed up at my computer every day, and I think I'd been doing a lot of work in the year previous that, you know, of ruminating and meditating on the project I didn't know was going to emerge. And so when I showed up at my computer every day, it just came out. It was such a crazy experience. You hear writers and artists talk about that sort of thing, and I'd always been very skeptical of it, but it really did just sort of come. And this project, you know, I think I sat down with an idea of what it was going to be. I knew that I wanted to work with medical language, and I had this idea that I wanted to try to write a love story. And that wasn't quite what it was supposed to be. And so I think first it took me some time to work through that aspect of it and move the project towards what it wanted to be. And then secondly, I actually, you know, I did a lot of research for this project. And I think it took me some time to pare down the research, because I can totally geek out on all of that scientific knowledge and get sort of attached to it and not want to let it go. And the truth is, for a poetic, you know, lyric project like this, you can't keep very much of it. It's fairly clunky. And so there was a process of needing to let go of some of the information that I wanted to incorporate. And the form also changed quite a bit over those years of working and reworking. And it went from a bunch of really short, almost prose poems, into these longer lyric essays. So it really was this sort of process of letting the project change over time and become what it wanted and needed to be.
We'll continue talking about that in just a moment, but Ron is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Ron.
Hi.
Hi.
Enjoying the show. I served briefly as an EMT in West Virginia while in college. I was able to actually use sign language with a deaf person at the roadside while they were being ministered to after a car wreck. So that the sort of the romantic aspect of your involvement with the EMT, you know, just being able to help people, you know, is quite, it's a wonderful experience to be able to have that, and thanks for sharing it. I've also experienced this pain of psychic pain of like tinnitus, and I just was your thing about risk assessment made me wonder if how many people know that if they, you know, have their ears overstimulated at concerts and stuff, they can get this thing that continues. It turns out that your sense of hearing is extremely valuable, and it's hard to turn off the cue of irritation if you ever get this screaming tinnitus noise. A lot of the vets have that. So, you know, part of that you might work into your assessment of risk is to take care of your hearing, because psychically the pain from that can be worse than a lot of physical things.
Sure.
And so it's you know, I think our psychic adjustment to risk is a complex thing.
Well, Ron, tell me, as you took care of people along mountain roads, which I'm sure were quite dangerous for driving, what did you learn about vulnerability as you helped people who'd been in accidents?
Well, you know, you just saw life as, you know, connected to something you do every day, driving a car, or just, you know, wanting to live back in the backwoods in the wintertime, you know, and then all of a sudden it's a medical emergency in the wintertime, and you're going over four-wheel drive in the snow. And, you know, it's just you're always open to, you know, the immediacy of, you know, that the body's need and how that can kind of bring you into relationships and new, you know, adventures or threats, you know, as the case is. So it brought it home that, you know, the most domestic scene, you know, just can have that, can turn south on you real quick.
Well, and this was something you did during college, Ron. Did that shape you as you went on after school?
Well, I've been involved with community, you know, service work. So I think that's been kind of my long-term angle. I tutor now over at Kirkwood, and so it's kind of a it's just been one more chapter in unfolding sort of some community service. I think my parents modeled that for me. So that was the main thing, though, was that you'd be studying in the ambulance garage, and when you get bored with studying, then the bell would ring, and you knew you weren't going to be bored for the next half hour. So kind of a dramatic way to punctuate your study routine.
Sure. Ron, thank you so much for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I'm talking with Ariane Zwartje. She is the author of the new book, Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy. The book, through lyrical essays, explores the human body in many different ways, and also our vulnerability both physically and emotionally, and our resilience as human beings. We'd love for you to join our conversation. If you have a story about a moment when you realized your own personal vulnerability or your own personal resilience, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Ariane Zwartje. She is the author of the new book, Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy, published by University of Iowa Press. And Ariane, there is a type of injury that we haven't explored yet. There are many types of injuries we haven't explored yet, but you explore it in your section called The Brain. Could you read a little bit of that for us?
Absolutely. I recently heard a story on NPR. In it, a woman describes her last years with her husband. He had Parkinson's, and also he liked to cross-dress. For her, these years were challenging and often painful. At the end of the story, she stated, "As hard as life was, when people say to me, 'Now that Doug's gone, you could date,' I would never be interested in being with anybody else. Does that sound strange to you? It sounds strange to me. Doug was my beloved person. That's who he was for me. Her beloved person. I didn't ever think I would put faith in something like that. But now I find myself wanting to believe it, and wanting to profess. It's an act of faith. It's an attempt. We all know we're human, but sometimes we want to believe anyway. What changes in our brains and in ourselves when we find that kind of connection, a connection that is lasting? Some researchers have speculated that we go through a sequence of love styles in our lives, from mania or obsession in adolescence to eros or romance, and then to companionship and pragmatic love in our middle years, and finally, later in life, to agape, all-giving love. But perhaps these stages are not limited to particular decades of our lives. Perhaps we're capable of circling around and around as our lives and selves flux. Certainly, brain chemistry research has shown a significant obsessive component in the brains of people newly in love, be they teens or adults. But what happens? What has to change to make that love last, to make someone become a beloved person? A recent study out of Stony Brook University looked at the brain reactions of couples still in love after 20-some years of marriage. The researchers began with the idea that long-term love and new love are similar, both stimulating parts of the brain related to reward and motivation. And they did find that, just like people newly in love, those in lasting romantic love showed activity in dopamine-rich parts of the brain, regions that respond to rewards, such as food, monetary gain, cocaine, and alcohol. The researchers write, these data suggest that the reward value associated with a long-term partner may be sustained, similar to new love. They point to the definition of romantic love, desire for union with another, suggesting that sense of unity may become the reward. The researchers also found that, in contrast to newly in love couples, these long-term lovers had more, rather than less, going on in their brains. They displayed attachment and liking toward their partner, in addition to the dopamine rush of wanting. They showed brain activity in an area thought to indicate emotions of warmth and tenderness. Strikingly, the researchers also found activity in brain areas relating to self-awareness. This connects to a model of romantic love as rapid growth, the expansion that comes with incorporating another person into the idea of self. Such intense opening and enlarging is common early in the process of falling in love, as we begin to integrate the loved one into our lives. It tends to decrease over time, however, as we become known to each other. This research suggests that in long loving couples, the self-expansion can continue at a high level, that if both partners continue to grow, to see each other as new, and if the relationship becomes a part of their growth, the sense of opening and expansion can endure.
Ariane Zwartz's reading from Detailing Trauma, a Poetic Anatomy. And since you've now told us that the love story that inspired the love story within this book has ended, that changes how I read that section. But it seems that you were reaching for evidence of a permanence of love.
Maybe not permanence. I'm not sure I'm ready to go quite that far, but I think I was, and maybe the project, you know, was really much larger than that particular relationship. I think maybe it was an attempt to believe in the strength of relationships and that there are relationships that can last. And, you know, I think I try to stray away from words like permanent or forever, both as a medic and just as a person who lives in this world full of fracture. But I think it was a project of allowing myself to hope or to believe that kind of long-lasting love is possible.
Throughout the book, you allude to your grandmother at different times, and then late in the book, you actually write about the fact that she had Alzheimer's. And you kind of explore identity and the fact that there is this kind of injury that can rob us of our identity, which in many ways seems like the cruelest kind of injury there is.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think I'm not sure which story comes through more strongly to someone reading the book, the story of my grandmother or the story of my grandfather, her husband. My grandmother is actually still alive. She's had Alzheimer's for probably 15 years. For the past 4 or 5 years, she hasn't recognized anyone or spoken much. And, you know, that is a horrifying process to watch erode someone that you love very much. But I think in a way, maybe what is more present to me right now is the story of my grandfather, her partner, who I watched take care of her and love her as she was going through that process, and his immense love for her and his immense equanimity are so inspiring to me. He passed away several years ago, as I wrote in the book, but he remains a really inspirational figure in my life. And part of it is watching his immense love for her over time through this really hard process. And then part of it is watching him be an immensely meditative, giving person in the world and taking care of other people his whole life. And then passing also with this immense grace and having such faith in the fact that you know, he was moving on to further journeys and further travels.
You write about listening to the radio. Apparently you listen to National Public Radio quite a lot. I picked that up from the book.
I do.
But you write about listening to what I assume was a StoryCorps moment on the radio where you're hearing a woman interviewing her husband who had early onset Alzheimer's. And he's expressing in the interview, he's expressing this faith that in spite of the fact that he is in many ways losing himself, that his children and his grandchildren will be able to see the man that he is anyway. And when you were listening to that, you were thinking, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, that was a hard story to listen to. You know, as I mentioned, I've watched my grandfather take care of my grandmother, and now my mother goes every day to see her mother in the nursing home that she's in and washes her face and massages her legs. And it's immensely tender and heartbreaking to watch that. But, you know, I've seen that process, and it erodes who people are. And, you know, I think maybe in some ways it's more tragic to the rest of the family. I'm not sure how aware, for example, my grandmother has been of that process. Although in that middle ground, I think where people can still remember some things, it's very difficult for everyone. It's very heartbreaking.
You write about, in another section of the book, you write about what a person goes through when they die, what a person who is taken off of life support may experience. And you write that in people learning about what that is going to be like, that some people choose not to be with their loved one at that moment because that's not how they want to remember them. And I see these things as kind of linked, those last memories. Do you think they supplant the earlier memories?
I don't think so. The spunky, fun-loving prankster that my grandmother was when she was younger is still very present in my mind. They feel like separate people to me, certainly, but I don't think that's a choice I personally would make, to choose not to be there or to choose not to witness that. I think, you know, to some degree, we live in a society that doesn't want to confront death, really doesn't want to confront death. And I think, you know, I think in some ways it's very healthy for us to be more present with and more aware of the full sort of circle of life, if you will. That's a little cliche and cheesy, but the whole realm of our human experience. Because I think if we don't confront the reality that death exists and we all will die, it somehow we're not as rooted in the present moment of being alive.
We talked earlier about the fact that this book took you 4 years to write, and obviously you were doing a great many other things during that time, but you kept returning to this subject, and I'm sure that there were parts of the book that you had to go through many, many different times and really focus on. How do you think that shaped your worldview, having this project be a part of your life for so long?
That's a really good question. I think in a way my answer has more to do with how the project changed as I changed as a person, you know, moving from sort of the start of the project where I was newly in love and newly taking on this medical training to the end of the project where this relationship had dissolved and I had actually started to have a regular meditation practice. And I think in some ways I couldn't finish it until I had been in that meditation practice for about a year. I think I realized in some ways that it was as much about my grandfather and his passing and the way he lived his life and about finding this certain kind of grace with all this uncertainty as it was about that as much as it was about, you know, this love story or anything else. So I think the project actually changed with me. And there were definitely times when I sat down to revise and was like, oh my gosh, this is a totally different voice. It's a totally different part of myself that was writing this. And so I think that was part of why the revisions were so intensive, was that when you stretch it over that long a time, you know, you change and your voice changes. And so you can't actually leave even the parts that seem okay alone because they're no longer in the voice you're writing in.
In a very small part of the book, you were writing about, it's kind of an aside in one of the essays where you write about someone who had lost her partner in a rock climbing accident, in a rappelling accident. Mm. And her comment was something along the lines of, now that he's gone, she can't justify not doing things that she loves. Mm-hmm. Something along those lines. Did you find that kind of an epiphany through focusing on all of these different ways that we can be injured?
I think so. You know, it's hard, again, to separate the medical knowledge and the way that leads you to confront our physical mortality. Hard to separate that from also the meditation practice, which certainly encourages that sort of awareness. But it's definitely been a journey in the past 5 years of my life towards trying to be more grateful for exactly what I have in this present moment, and trying to keep the awareness in the forefront of my mind that you just never know what's around the next corner. There are continuous surprises, both wonderful and terrifying. And so I think, you know, as sort of overwhelming as that seems, the more that I've been able to embrace that reality, the more I've been able to be really present with the people around me and just be so immensely grateful for the presence of all the people I love and how beautiful the autumn has been in New Mexico and, you know, just every moment in my daily life.
What do you hope people who read your book will take away from it?
What a wonderful question. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I do have a certain joy in the geekiness of the medical knowledge. So there is a certain hope that people will enjoy that aspect of things as much as I do, both the crazy, quirky factoids and also the just poetic beauty to me of all that body language. But I think, you know, in a much larger sense, I strive in these projects to observe and bear witness and explore, you know, what it means to be human. And I think we start from our personal experience always and see the world through that lens. And so the desire to explore myself and my physical embodied experience in this world, I think I hope that readers will also spend some, you know, time exploring that line of thought as they go through the book.
Arianne Zwartjes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Arianne Zwartjes is the author most recently of Detailing Trauma, A Poetic Anatomy. She's also the director of the Wilderness Program at the United World College in New Mexico. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime if there's something on the show you'd like to talk about or if there's something you'd like to hear on the show. We want to hear from you. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at close presidential elections through history. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.